Individual?
Accountable individual, I think is right.
Something like this. I'm close. That was my favorite thing out of that whole thing.
Yeah.
It may have been all right. Responsible individual.
Well, and it's a mistake that Jeremy Institute always made, is they always had two people there and they were both responsible. Well, if you're both responsible, neither is, right? And there's that other article I sent you guys around, which basically said that if people don't know who's responsible, they always push the responsibility up the chain, right? So if they don't know who's responsible and going to be held accountable for it, then they always push it up and it becomes not their problem, right? But you've got to develop that current culture of no excuses and having a person in charge, right? That's why, 20-some years ago, I changed it to there was a branch manager and then his staff. And it's the same way, by the way, Tiger Shulman's structure things, same way Bill Clark structures things. The terminology may be different, but if you have a person in charge at that location, and it's difficult, conversation you and I had, it's difficult to have, like, the instructor and then the person who's in charge of retention and renewals. Well, who's responsible for retention and renewals? Well, to a great extent, the instructor, right? And I can be the greatest salesperson in the world, but if I don't have the instructor doing the right things, the deal doesn't happen. So it's a difficult balance. But so what I'm saying is from your guys' standpoint, it seems to me that one big issue is in systematizing the marketing and pretty rapidly as you go up the chain is trading labor for money. Because as you get financial abundance, you don't get now more time, right? The more financial abundance that you end up that you end up creating, you still have the same number of hours, and frankly the next step in lifestyle is to have the hours to go fishing every Friday with the grandkids like Mike likes to do, rather than having to be out there, taking rack cards out and so forth. From a multi-school operator standpoint, is a lot of times it's a lot easier to spend money than it is to get, to get the cats herded in the right direction, right? So the next thing on the people management side is even in a single school, fairly tight staffed operation, I very rarely see this ongoing training and supervision happening very well. And see, like in my case, for 25 years, we had a 2 or 3 hour staff meeting every Monday morning and a 2 or 3 hour staff meeting every Wednesday night or every Wednesday morning. And the Junior Institute, it was 5 hours every Friday. So there was the Junior Institute, there was a couple of hours of all the guys training together, and there was an hour and a half or so of instructor training and program director training separate, then there was an hour and a half or so of business meeting together. I always figured it's better up to break it up into a couple chunks. But, in my case, with multiples, there was a 2 or 3 hour meeting twice a week, but then there was a 30 to 45 minute at every school that the branch managers were expected to do to start the day, and then there was a 20 to 30 meeting to recap the day at the end of the day every day. And so if you don't have that structure in place, what happens is a day after day goes by and the group doesn't know what's going on. You end up at the end of the month, the numbers were bad, but you didn't fix it on Wednesday, the first week of the month, right? I mean, you've got to have that ongoing thing. And so this is a general topic, seems to me, the biggest issue that happens for everybody here as you grow, right? But again, subsetting it in, an important component is the culture, another component is the day-to-day small level meeting training, and a bigger issue is growing to another level. One of the things that Mike said, I think that's interesting to take in terminology, he talked about the guys leaving and how successful they were as they left. Now that's an interesting component, and it's something, I'll go back to the Junior Institute, if I look at how many leaders in the industry that organization created, is it tells you something about what their training strengths were, right? I've had, I don't know how many people tell me, that they were pissed off while they were working for me about how much training I made them go through, but then wherever they left and went to, they were better trained than anybody else that they had done. I have a young man who's coming back into the organization now, but when he was in college, he was working for me, and then he went to work for this other company I mentioned before, Ultimate Electronics. And when he was applying for a job for them as a sales manager, because his father-in-law was the president of the company, is he had done more sales training than their general sales manager for the entire organization. Is the guy asked him what he had read, and he gave him the syllabus of all the stuff that I had made him do, and the guy was better trained than anybody but their executive staff. And so that's the way you've got to think about your staff. The other thing that's interesting is, and I had this conversation with Jeff Smith recently, and this goes back 30 or 40 years, but June Reed Institute used to train the instructors and train the program directors separately. Because we have a few people that have come back in that were like from that period of time when they were cross-trained, and then had shifted where everybody was 100% cross-trained in both roles. And see, you can argue this both ways, but see, if all of your instructors don't know all your sales processes, I think you have a problem. And if all of your program directors aren't completely fluent and not necessarily are capable to be the head instructor, but aren't completely fluent in what the processes are, how the floor systems work, how everything else works, you've got a problem. And where a lot of people create a problem for themselves at a low level is you treat all the martial arts people like they're not part of the business. And at a bigger level, you create it like there's functional barriers that you don't let people cross over. Is that creates a huge problem if you're not careful. Does that make sense? And in one hand, you want this person to be able to step into this person's role. But on the other hand, it's Eric and Hein. They were having a big challenge. But you know what they had done is they had grown so big so fast that they now had the program director doing business stuff and a series of instructors, but the instructors weren't talking to the program directors about individual people every day. Right? So now students were like metaphorically being tossed over the wall, but they weren't being tracked through the system smoothly. And it's a common occurrence. Thiel Valley years ago tried to staff it where he had an enrollment program director and a renewal program director. Well, it never worked. Never worked because there's too many handoffs, right? So this person would deal with them, then 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 this person would deal with them. Too many handoffs, right? It needed to be one person. When he moved to Florida, is he started thinking about that one location that he had as actually being two schools. But they were staffed with staff for that particular set of students, not staffed in functional roles where somebody was trying, a different person who did the enrollment was trying to do the renewal. Does that make sense? So, but you've got it. But that's, you know, the second big piece. The third piece that I see going haywire a lot is the behind-the-scenes financial management. And, again, unusual in our industry, but there's an awful lot of people in this room that can look at numbers and understand them and get a pretty good sense of it. But that's unusual in the martial arts industry, right? Is what you've got to be aware of, though, is that if you're not paying attention and know what all the numbers mean and benchmark against it, you're missing a big piece. And you have the operations numbers that generally you would separate in this way. So you have marketing results numbers, sales efficacy numbers, student results numbers, all of which lead to the top line revenue that then you need to track adequately through your profit and loss, so you end up with a big net. And see, the big problem in multiple school operations is all the money gets spent. Right? The big problem in a single school as it grows is that the expenses grow out of proportion to the revenue growth. Right? Same problem, you know, different reasons for it. What happens in a multiple school is the administrative overhead gets to be too big. Okay, so all of a sudden you have too many people supervising the people because it's tough to herd cats. So suddenly, right? So suddenly you have all this administrative overhead, you know, trying to herd the cats. In a small school operation, what has a tendency to happen is you end up with too many headcount people getting paid. And since you're there as the owner-operator, You don't get like a few really good high paid people, you just end up with a bunch of them, right? And I've heard, you know, in reading different companies, I've heard, I think Bill Gates and Zuckerberg, I'm trying to remember who the other one was, both of them described hiring programmers. And I think it Zuckerberg has said that the difference between a good programmer and a great programmer wasn't like double the output, it was like 10 times the output, okay, maybe even 100 times. And one of the conversations in Apple was the same thing, is Jobs called as staffing the company with A players. And he said when he came back to Apple, is that Pixar had nothing but A players and Apple had a ton of B and C players. And his tough part was figuring out who the C's and B's were to get rid of them and finding new ways to put in their place. But the thing that happens is if you're not careful, you end up with a lot of people. And especially if you have sympathy for them and, you know, like them and have grown them, you tolerate people who aren't very good with a lot of them rather than having a few really, really hot shots, right? The other thing about really good people is they're more difficult to manage in some ways, right? Because they're headstrong. So you've got to be careful not to have the ones that you're comfortable with only. You've got to have the ones that are going to be high performers and be very careful about that. So, but again, what I see a lot of times is, and you know, in general terms, see, you want to make sure that you're being very careful about what you're spending in rent and that it's justifiable. Number two is you've got to look at your overall percentage of payroll. But just as important is that you have a few really good people who are getting paid 20% more than they can make anywhere else. Not just a bunch of people that are on the payroll, right? The next thing you've got to do is you've got to be really paying attention to your return on investment on your marketing budget. But again, a lot of you in the room are over this now, but it's either labor or it's money. And if it's a single school operation, you can get away with it being labor because you're out there every day hustling. I will tell you that once you get to a certain level of net income, is you get tired of that, right? I remember, again, use Keith Hafner's example. I remember sitting down and describing to him the program that you're doing as well, the school program in the schools. And his comment to me was instructive, and he was right. Is he said, well, he said, you know, that... He said, my schedule right now is I get up at, I think it was 5. He says, I have an hour set aside for prayer. I have an hour set aside for planning. I go to the school at 8. I come back home at 11. He said, I work out in my home gym. I sit in the tanning bed in the winter. I lay out the pool and do some reading in the summer. I have a little lunch. I go back to the school at 3:30. I'm at the school till late. And he said, what you just described would be right in the middle of my lunch, workout, tanning, reading time. And now, put this in context of $1 million-a-year school netting half a million, right? Is, in his case, did he? If it's $10,000 a month paying for advertising, versus cut into his reading tanning time, which is the better trade-off?
10 grand.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he was right. I never could get him to do it. And I gave him my best shot because I had to stay, you know, well, you've got both your kids working for you and you've got your brother working for you. They don't have to have your lifestyle. You can get, but you know, in his mind, pool time, tanning time, workout time, I ain't going to go do this thing, right? And... But you do have to, as you look at these numbers. In fact, this is you've got this cash sheet. Okay, let's look at this one. Let's pass this around. Let's talk about this though.
I'm not sure. We're yes. Going over the percentages again because we're trying to watch them really close as to what you recommend they are.
Absolutely. Yes. let's first start, Mike, with revenue.
I appreciate seeing myself with more hair.
You know, I've looked at a lot of schools, and since we did this little regional seminar tour, and I started talking to people one-on-one on the phone, we're probably up to what, Toby? I've talked to 300 people or something like that. Pretty big number, whatever it is. I have yet to come across anybody with a high net that is really creating like 12 different income streams that all go into the top line revenue number and making it all work. You know what I'm saying by that? Is, again, go back to a story about Apple. One of the interesting things I thought was in that bio is this, is that when Jobs came back in, right? And, you know, the short version of the story is he was the founder of the company. They launched the Mac. And somewhere along the line, he hired John Sculley from PepsiCo. And suddenly him and the other corporate guys thought that Jobs was too hard to manage because he was too willful. And they tried to move him into a role that was, like, really just on the periphery as a figurehead. And he quit in a huff and sold all the stock and kept one share. And he went and founded Next Computer with among others, Ross Perot as an investor and Canada as an investor. And then he bought Pixar. And then down the line, and, you know, Apple at that point was a huge huge company. I mean, when before he quit, they had the biggest IPO in history up to that point, I think. And he was worth like $250 million when he quit. But he went and did Next Computer. But then over the years with the people they had one thing or another, they never had managed to get a good operating system that was going to update the Mac operating system. And the year that he came back, they had lost in the most recent quarter of $1 billion.
Weren't they close to going bankrupt?
Well, they were like 90 days from being out of business. And part of what kept them in business is they got a cash injection from Bill Gates. So Bill Gates gave them like $200 million, $180 million, something like that, a big amount of money, not relative to what they were bleeding. But the biggest thing with Gates was they got a commitment from Gates to keep making Microsoft Office for the Mac because they were getting ready to kill him. But here was the thing is, at the time, Apple was making printers, cameras, all kinds of stuff. I mean, they had like 30 different versions of Mac. They had a bunch of printers, one thing or another. And they talk about in the book how Jobs basically went to every division, looked at everything, looked at all Newton. They were making Newton at the time. Looked at everything. And then he came in and brought all the key people in the company together and said, here's what we're making from now on. He said, he's making a home and a professional, portable, and a desktop. Everybody looked at him like he was crazy because they had like 500 products. He said, no. I just called HP. I asked them to take our printer business. You know, they do that well. We do it crappy. We're going to kill Newton. We're going to have four Macs. One of these. That's the entire product line. It is a multi-billion dollar company, right? Now, if you look at them even right now, what's their product line?
Well, iPads, iPods.
Well, they have basically four Macs, right? They have a professional Mac, Mac Pro. They have a professional portable, MacBook Pro. They have a home Mac Air, and they have a home Mac iMac, right? Now, there's a couple of iterations of those now. And then they have an iPod, an iPhone, and an iPad. I mean, that's it, right? And they have to have iTunes and iBooks because it feeds the ecosystem, but it's really rounding error in the scheme of things for them. And the App Store, by the way. So, you know, the three of them together are like a multi-billion dollar business, but it just feeds the ecosystem. So really, I mean, how many other businesses that are that big have that small a product line? Hardly anybody. But that was part of the genius. And see, what I see our industry do is, well, I'm going to add a cardio kickboxing program to add another $3,000 to the revenue. Oh, well, if I have this seminar and charge everybody, I can make a little bit of extra revenue. Well, if I'm really going to get to work in my pro shop and get it from $2,000 to $4,000, I haven't yet seen anybody who's very profitable, but that's their deal. Is in almost all cases, they have one or two sources of revenue, occasionally three, and that's the deal, right? So go back to your question about breaking it down. Is I think the first thing is figure out what you are and be that and be better than anybody else at it, right? And then don't do anything half-assed. So it doesn't mean like, let's take Eric and Heise's case. You know, if they're doing a women's cardio kickboxing program and they're doing an adult men Brazilian jiu-jitsu program, it doesn't mean they have to kill one or the other. But is the women's cardio kickboxing program contributing 30, 40, 50% of the revenue? Is it running a high net profit? If that's the case, great. If not, fix it. You know, fix it or kill it. It's like the conversation we had about Aikido, right? I mean, either make it $250,000 revenue stream or, you know, why bother, right? So the second thing is now the argument of billing versus cash at the school. And the best mix I've seen is about 50-50. Meaning down payments, paid in fulls, all of that ends up being about half of the revenue. Now, if you end up with the short-term money being more than half of the revenue, you end up with a pretty unstable environment, your peaks and valleys, right? So on the other hand, if you end up with billing being 90%, hell, we had Randy Eldridge, his billing was like 100% of his revenue. He didn't even do down payments. They came in, they signed a year contract, they got 30 days free, and then they could cancel at any time with 90 days, and everything went into billing. So he had a $30,000 billing check and no cash at the school, right? Anytime the billing ends up being much over 65 or 70%, you're leaving a lot of money on the table. Steele Valley, one of the ways we got his revenue to double is he went from the billing check was 80% of the revenue to the billing check was 50% of the revenue. Is he doubled the gross almost overnight. He went from $50,000 a month to almost $100,000 a month just by having more down payments and more paid in fulls, right? So that's, I think, a couple of revenue issues. Is one is trying to have a bunch of little streams of income. The Coke machine in the lobby, the juice bar, retail, pro shop, seminar, the exam fees. Having a bunch of little pieces of revenue, what it has a tendency to do is actually dampen the revenue per student. And it has a tendency to get you distracted. And again, with a given number of staff, if you have somebody going to collect $20, it might be the same amount of time as it would take them to sign a $15,000, $20,000 renewal. Right? So you've got to be careful about all those little hits. The other piece of it that I would argue is that it's about that emotional bank account idea, Covey's idea, which is, you know, every time you go ding somebody for money, you're having a negative, not a positive impact on their relationship with you. So whether they're writing a check for $500 or for $50, I think it's the same level of impact emotionally that you're having with them. So I'd rather it be a big check. Does that make sense? So, and then now you have your expense structure. And overall, I would say that your rent shouldn't be more than 12-15% of your gross. Now, there's a couple of issues with this. Is almost everybody leans towards having too much square footage. And I think it's like if you go to the popular Italian restaurant and all the seats, all the tables are full and there's an hour wait, you assume it's good and you want to go back. And if you go to the restaurant, there's 500 tables and there's three people in it, you assume that, you know, they must have failed the health inspection and, you know, the food is crappy. So as you look at facilities, you want to be careful not to expand the square footage to the point that it doesn't look like that you're thriving, right? That's part of it. The other part is an expense. And in my own case, with multiple locations for a long time, with six locations, the biggest square footage location I had was the smallest enrollment, and the smallest square footage I had was the biggest enrollment. And the smallest square footage location was the most profitable. Now, the smallest I ever had at the time was 2,400 square feet, so we're not talking about it was 900 square feet. But the 24, 25, it always seemed that I could max out two to 3,000 square foot better. And that once it started getting over that, it had a counter effect. Now, that's not doing after-school transport care and stuff. That requires a lot of square footage, as you guys know. But so the other component of rent, by the way, is you've got to separate rent into the square footage that you're using and into the marketing effect that it has. So, like Chris Bro, who's not here, his shopping center, he's in the same shopping center as a busy Costco. He has to do very little marketing because he gets flooded with just people coming into the Costco and stumbling into the school. Well, how much is that worth? Right? So make sure you always recognize that component of the rent. You know, if I have my druthers right now with our franchises, I'm going to go for high per square foot rent, 2,000, 2,200 square foot of space in a high profile, high volume, busy place. Not that I couldn't replace the same amount of effort with labor, but I know that in most cases they're not going to. So I'd rather them have a certain amount of traffic they're going to get just by opening the doors every morning. Does that make sense? So the next major expense is obviously payroll. And this is a funny one because, again, go back to the other examples. One of the conversations in that other book I read about Apple was that you know, they had put in so many high-quality people when they rewrote Safari for the iPhone operating system. How big a team would you guess they had to do that? Robert, you know a little bit about that industry. If it was Microsoft, how many people would it take to rewrite Explorer?
100.
Yeah. Apple, they had two guys. Wow. Two guys rewrote the thing.
Yeah, I was going to say five.
They used two. So two guys rewrote the thing, right? Now, these were good programmers, right? So the funny thing is that as a percentage, I'm going to hem and haw a little bit, but think about this as kind of being the range, 25 to 38%. In a multiple school environment, I've always used 25% as my target. The reason I use 25% of the target is there's also corporate overhead. And so I've got a built-in payroll for the guy supervising and the guy who's running the thing.
Now that includes your pay as well.
Yeah. Now in that format.
Excuse me, Mr. Does it include the top person or
I was just breaking that down. In the 25%, Here's what my formula always was. 12% to the branch manager, 10% to either the program director or instructor working with them, 3% to all the part-timers. Okay? Now, you can extrapolate that as an owner-operator and do this is the owner-operator, this is the other full-time person, this is everybody else. Okay? Now, notice that I said there's a range here. Okay, as a single school owner-operator, if my payroll is around 33%, including me, I'd be okay. In a multiple school environment, like now Joe's in, he needs each of those schools to be 25%, and then he's going to layer in on top of it, right? Because he's got to have branch manager, program director, and instructor, part-timers in both locations. And he's got to have enough left over for himself. An experiment that Bill Clark did recently is he shifted his staff, the branch managers, to basically they would take out a certain amount for corporate overhead, a certain amount for him, and then the branch manager keep 80% of what was left over. Sounded like a good idea at the time. When he launched, they told me how great it was going, one thing or another. Do you know what the problem is with it? It is, by the way, hasn't worked out so well for him.
Say that again, how we did it.
He took top line.
He took the top line. Then he did, I think, 2,000 a month for corporate overhead, 2,000 or 3,000 a month for him. Built that into the expenses, and then the guy running the place keeps 80% of what's left over, and he gets 20%. What's the problem with that?
It's top line. You're not figuring.
Well, this was the guy running. It's keeping 80% of the net.
Oh, net.
Of the net, not the gross. Okay. Here's the problem. Multiple schools almost always look like this. So in his case, he's got a bunch. What, 25 still? But let's say that I've got 25 locations. Here's what the organization is going to look like, best case. So let's say this is 5, this is 10.
The old 80-20 rule, you're saying?
Yeah. This is 10, and this is, let's say, 5. Make it, well, that would be 20, so this is 10. Okay? 10 of them are going to be dead bang losers any given month. 10 of them are going to be holding their own, and 5 are going to be wildly profitable. So now, his 20% to the bottom line on these doesn't cover what he needs to put into these to keep them operating, and he's not getting anything from those. That's the way it ends up looking, right? So in his case, he ends up with, you know, 4 or 5 that are wildly profitable that, you know, you hear all the stories about, but also ends up with 7 or 10 where, you know, whatever happened, you know, a person quits, you're trying to replace them. They had, you know, the guy had a fight with the girlfriend that month. You know, the girl found out that she's got, you know, some disease, whatever. You know, I mean, you know, you've got, I mean, I could tell you every damn story you can in the world, right? But you've got some portion of them that are sucking wind, a small number of them that are bringing a huge amount of cash to the bottom line, and he didn't leave himself with enough cushion over here to take care of this stuff, right? So, but overall, from a payroll standpoint, if I was running a single school operation and this ended up maybe 33%, I'd be okay. Like, Jonathan, we looked at your numbers, and your payroll was running 25% without you, right? And so, one, the payroll was already high, right? And so I would want myself slotted in there, but then if I end up with maybe the rest of this is 20%, then I'm you know, on the range of being okay. Does that make sense? And then the third big piece is marketing. And there's a lot of different ways to look at this. My standard answer is 13 to 15% should be going down in marketing. And anytime you put that number in a percentage, you're always wrong, right? Because it's about return on investment. But see, in a bigger operation over long term, it's hard to think in terms of keeping the numbers running in range of on macro, looking at return on investment. On macro, you're looking at what the percentages are and seeing if they're in place or not. So when I look at somebody's numbers, if this is a particularly low number, then and their, you know, their gross isn't where it needs to be, that's one of the first places to look. On the other hand, what we're doing with most of the franchises right now is they're feeding it with labor, not with money. And most of you are in the same place that our high-end franchisees are, which is you've been more comfortable over the years working to generate traffic than spending a ton of money. And the things that I'm working on with, you know, our school in Fresno and our guys in Australia and New Zealand and, you know, and so forth, is working on them trading money for time.
We just started this month with billboards, TV, and radio.
Yeah.
And the response, radio, we're going to do away with that, but the response from the billboards and TV have just been unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, for what I put into TV, I mean, my investment last month on TV was $1,200.
Right.
We signed 6 students.
Perfect.
It's crazy.
Yeah, $200 a piece, you can't beat that.
Look at doing long form radio.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
AM and like some low frequency FM channels that have, especially like conservative talk channels.
Yeah.
All, you can almost always buy an hour on Saturday or an hour on Sunday. And they're almost all people just like us. It's the guy who owns the auto repair shop. He does the fix it out. It's the guy who's a real estate agent and he has the real estate outlet. It's the guy who has a bank.
Yeah.
He has the finance outlet. And depending on what market you're in, you can get some of those things pretty cheap. Produce an hour long show. Fake some people calling in, put it on tape, and run it.
Yeah.
Drive to the website.
My only counterpoint to that is I haven't yet seen anybody do it.
No, I haven't done that.
And so
not in this industry, but all over the place. chiropractic, automotive, cosmetic surgery.
Well, I've meant to. I mean, when we produced that last infomercial, that was part of the whole package that I paid for, was to do that with the voice talent and everything. Just never got around to doing it.
Has anybody done anything with public access, creating some, a number of shows? And,
yeah. That's one of the things John Graydon and Tom Callis had both done for a long time. Dave Kovar did it for a long time. I don't know if Dave is still doing it.
Show every Saturday.
Yeah.
Do they have to be studio quality? Will they?
No.
Like a DVD quality is enough for them to run on their system or not? Really?
Well, the last time I looked at this, I don't know what has changed. Hey, has anybody in here done the public access TV shows? The problem with the public access TV show is you're showing up at the studio filming a new TV show every week. And it's not that you can put one in the can and they'll just run it for you over and over and over again. It's got to be like...
Well, how about if you ran, you produced like 5 or 6 of them, put them on DVD and gave them to them? Because they run them multiple times, right? They run them usually over and over again.
Yeah.
So I mean,
time available.
If you gave them, say, a month's work, where you produce 4 of them, and I don't know.
Well, yeah, I looked into this very extensively at one time, and once you have one, they can do what they call bicycling it out, which means they roll it into other markets. If you had a reason to do that, the biggest challenge is it's not like they let you run an infomercial, right? So it's not that your phone number is flashing on screen and your website's flashing on screen and you're breaking every 7 minutes for a pitch. It's got to be informational, right? And so now the question is, June Reed is the type that would have done this. He went down to teach Congress twice a week for 50 years for free, for God's sake. But you got to be willing to get up and out of bed in the morning. Go do the thing every Saturday and do it as just an informational piece, not as a promotional tool. And, in my case, when I was looking at doing it, we could produce an infomercial for $20,000 and then I could run it every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. for $1,000 and buying 30 seconds on a real TV station or 30 minutes on a real TV station for something that was going to work was a whole lot more worth my time than the other thing. I've heard people, again, Tom and John Graydon were two of them, who swore by it. Because in a market like Reno or in a market like Tampa, is they became little local celebrities because they're on TV all the time. But I got to tell you, in Denver, which is a hell of a bigger market than either one of them, I was the same way with the infomercial, but I was spending $1,000 a week not getting out of bed every morning at Saturday and going and producing a new one.
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of like, for example, taking one of the books that we did, mm-hmm. right, and choosing 4 or 5 chapters in the books, well, character development, but rolling it into martial arts, and doing like a pre-planned little half hour show, use some of the kids, film them, edit them myself, and they'll accept it that way, and just say, here's 5 DVDs, you can run them, blah blah blah, and if they run them multiple times, if it works, then do it and roll, do it again 6 months from now.
I don't know whether you can get them to do that. I think you probably, again, this is dated information. You probably have to end up with it being like a weekly show that you go do. You could do the same thing and go film 25 of them, and then have it recycle and do that. And 25, if you did it down and dirty, what's that? You could get it done in 100 hours, and then have something that would run for the year. But, it's 100 hours of your time, so.
I know on the traffic side.
Yeah.
But I know a bunch of people who are doing this outside the industry. But my favorite guy is he's a orthopedic surgeon. He does also, prosthetics, right? So that's his number one lead generator for prosthetic treatments is his radio show. Right?
Yeah.
And it's a mobile prosthetics business that he franchised.
Mm-hmm.
So he teaches people how to go buy a truck and out to your mm-hmm. location and fit you for your leg. To what you were saying about how you can't be an infomercial, well, now with web, you just drive into a free resource online every 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You're every 4 minutes. You know what I mean? So the guy calls into the radio show, his problem is X. You answer.
You're talking radio, not TV.
Yeah. Very similar. But I mean, so the guy calls.
Has anybody looked into the public access thing recently? I don't know how much has changed. Because, of course, now it's dominated by DirecTV and DishNet. And the cable access, the access was always... Well,
I think you got to look, too. I mean, like, even for us, Fios is huge where we are, just as big as cable. So by being on cable, we lost half the customers, you know.
Fios.
Verizon.
Oh, Verizon. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, you've got your cable company, you've got your phone company, and then you've got the Dish Network and the other one. I mean, you're really cutting pieces.
Yeah. Well, when we ran the infomercial, it was kind of a unique situation, but it was a local broadcast channel that got picked up by all the cable networks, right? So we were in, at the time, everybody but DirecTV, right? And now DirecTV has to pick up local channels. So if you were buying infomercial time on the local cable or the local NBC, CBS, ABC affiliate, is you're now also ending up on DirecTV. But I don't know. I haven't looked into the public access thing for quite a while.
Okay.
I can tell you in that case, I never heard Dave swearing by it. I don't know if he thought that was worthwhile or not. Tom and John used to both swear by it. And I know what John liked is he liked, I'm now a local celebrity. Right. And so that's where he did. He got Tony Robbins to show up one time for the show, and he used it to get on like regular news shows and stuff a lot because now he was a media personality. And he was pretty smart in using it that way. My sense is you'd want to really do a lot of research before you go, do the show. And
that's why I brought it up. I just wondered if anybody had done it or what you knew about it, because it's something I've been thinking about.
I had spent a lot of time looking at it. I mean, with the videographer that we had for a lot of time, see, that's what he did, is he did those things. And we were looking at how to roll it out nationally, and you can bicycle around to the other stations and so forth. But by the time it got done, to me, it was just time. I did not want to spend that much time to do something. And literally, I waited it out with, I'm buying 30 minutes on a Prime show for $1,000, and I can do that four times a month, or I can spend an hour.
But you got the production costs that are going to be, really high with the
commercial. Well, there's still production costs with doing a live show.
I'm saying, though, is if they'll allow us to do it, we'll do it myself.
So some community colleges, too, have, like, media programs. Yeah. Where you can go in there and shoot it, and they'll do it all for you. But public access would be forward, too.
Yeah, but there's still costs involved to do the production.
I would see if people are watching that anymore, too, because 10 years ago, 5 years ago, people watched that. Now, 1,000 channels.
There's so many channels,
Yeah. See, I think I think Eric's right. I think the dynamics have changed quite a bit.
Let's shift a second to not infomercials, but spots, like TV spots. Yeah. Has anybody had any success with TV spots?
Huge. Yeah.
We have. And we're going to expand it. We're looking at March now, running all the programs across and adding extra TV.
What did you buy? What was your media buy?
What was it?
You bought like 200 spots or something like that?
It's more than that. It was more than that. And we just also, I gave them a referral, somebody I know, and they just gave me 100 free spots.
Yeah.
We targeted it to all the women's channels.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people usually target kids' channels. I know now from having kids and watching my wife at home with the kids, she doesn't watch TV with them. It's a babysitter, so she can get the dishes done or something else done for a half hour while they put a show on.
To a great extent, sure.
Yeah, so we actually targeted Food Network, TLC, E!, Bravo, those channels, specifically Oprah. And it's just been crazy. I mean, everybody that calls us, saw the TV commercial or... They see, we did a very testimonial. I have it on here if anybody wants to see it.
Yeah.
But we did a very testimonial-driven TV commercial for the kickboxing program first. We're going to do the karate program in a second.
We'll set that up and run it tomorrow.
Yeah.
that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I ran a karate one years ago, and it was a bust. It really was.
You know, we tried something different this time. I didn't want to do the typical TV commercial where they just kind of scan the school and talk about you. Yeah. We went straight for the testimony. Mm-hmm. The entire 30-second spot's testimonies. The entire 30-second spot, and then the offers blinking across.
I think I saw you kickboxing one.
Yeah. And we're going to do the same thing for the karate one that we're going to do, which starts running in March.
And to answer your question, Mike, I've spent probably close to $1 million in TV over the years, and had a lot more home runs than strikeouts. And again, the dynamic has changed, right? I mean, in the big advertisers, if you look, all you have to do is look at Apprentice and American Idol, and they're the models of what the new advertising model is, because you know it's all embedded. Right, the Coke cup and so forth. And of course, nobody has the budget to do that. But did you figure out how many spots and how much money you spent on it?
Last month was $1,200. I want to say it was close to 200 spots for the month. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've bought outward. It maybe even a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
But it's. The cable companies are good. You may buy 200 spots, but if they got empty airtime,
They'll keep throwing it.
Keep throwing it. Yeah.
Two years ago, I did a deal where it was $2,000 a month for 360 spots,
mm-hmm.
and I did it for the whole year, and it basically broke even.
Yeah,
but I wasn't doing kids' programs; I was doing the adults.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You just did the sampling in January and February, right? Or January?
Both. Yeah, in February has been just as good.
And it was
so
a fitness message.
Yeah.
And it was a fitness message in January.
Yes and no, but
You won't.
But that's we're targeting it that way.
Yeah, I think it's a misrepresentative sample. To it's great. I mean, but I think a fitness message in January is going to pull a lot different than a fitness message in July.
Yeah, people naturally.
And
probably about 80% more at least.
Yeah.
Well. This is probably a pretty useful topic. We were talking about TV advertising.
Right. Network or cable?
No, both. Well, he was talking about cable there. But, John?
No, I'm changing the subject, so go ahead.
Let's stay on TV for a bit, because, of any broadcast media that you can buy in a contained market, so where you're positioned right now in Buffalo, for you in Fishkill and so forth, and a lot of you are in this situation. I mean, if I was in Manhattan, I mean, you can't buy, I guess nowadays you can do zip code targeted. I mean, the media is changing a lot. The next iteration of TV is you're going to be able to buy demographics the way you buy direct mail.
Or buy pay-per-click.
Yeah, that's the next iteration.
They're so granular on it. I took a plane ride out to California. Mm-hmm. I sat next to the vice president of whatever. But anyway, they can get so granular that they know household by household what you're watching on your box, right?
Yeah.
They can't sell that. They can only sell it in blocks. They're federally regulated by the FCC. They can only sell that in certain blocks. And it's like, now I think you can buy neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't used to buy neighborhoods. Now I think just as of last December, you can now buy neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, DirecTV and Dish are going to be different, and Verizon is going to be different. Let's have the conversation. See, a big opportunity for you in Buffalo is are you doing much TV in Buffalo?
No. We've sat down with the cable people a couple of times, and I haven't liked the numbers yet. But
Yeah, the numbers you threw with me weren't giving me a great deal, I didn't think. But
what should you pay a spot? I mean,
Well, there's not a right answer to that.
It's ROI.
I think
the number we were at.
The network's a dollar for a 30-second spot. But
I think.
Well, if you read about the Super Bowl, what was the number? I wasn't prepared to write this down.
I think the average commercial was 1.2 million.
Well, I know, but somewhere I read, I don't know if it was Wall Street Journal or something. But they did an analysis of whether it was a good buy or not, and based upon cost per thousand. And if I remember correctly, the right number, but it was something like primetime network is running about $12 cost per thousand, and the Super Bowl was $20 cost per thousand, so therefore it wasn't a good buy because, to buy the same number of eyeballs, you could buy 40% more eyeballs by being on, CIS or something like that.
But that's not true because people watch the Super Bowl commercials where they don't watch the others.
Right. That's half the attraction.
Yeah, there is that point, too. Exactly. Well, and it's also why, you know, one of the most iconic Super Bowl commercials ever was the Apple launch of the Macintosh, right? And the, you know, in Apple's case, they had one of the most iconic home runs, but they also had one of the most iconic, you know, blunders. Do you guys know the backstory? The Apple launch Mac, the Mac launch, which was directed at IBM without ever saying it, was in 1984, and it was based upon the theme was 1984, and so they hired Ridley Scott, who did Blade Runner and so forth. They had a 1984 theme, and it was a girl in a tracksuit running through with a sledgehammer, and you know, there's a big video screen of the guy droning on that, ironically, kind of in retrospect looks like Bill Gates, but it wasn't aimed at Gates. It was it was aimed at Microsoft. But they threw the sledgehammer through the camera, and that was the release of the Macintosh. And the Macintosh, you know, did just ridiculous sales numbers immediately following that. But the next year, again, named at IBM, they had, it was based on Lemmings over the cliff, and so they had all these business guys in suits. But it was offensive to their target audience, and so it backfired. But you're buying how many eyeballs, right? So you're buying, when you're buying TV, you're buying impressions. So how many times your target audience sees it, and you're targeting eyeballs. So, you know, the right answer is you're looking for the lowest cost per exposure that you can get with the right demographic. But if you don't get enough repetition, it doesn't work, right? So in TV, you know, the old rule of thumb used to be you wanted everybody to see it 7 times. I would say now it's more like 12 or 15 times. So if you're not buying it so that the same audience is going to see it 12 to 15 times, you've got a problem, right? And you're looking at what your cost per thousand is, in being thousand. So what your cost per thousand is. And these numbers are going to be what your budget needs to be in order to have the impact you need to have is different across everybody's market. And, you know, buying broadcast, I used to have big results with Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles, which is a counterpoint to what you were saying about the parents not watching it with kids. The best results we had, though, were with buying Oprah and buying the 5 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news. So, June Reed years ago used to hit home run buying the Kung Fu TV show. We used to all have to go in at 7 o'clock on Saturday night and watch the phones because the Kung Fu TV show was going to come on. There's a range, though, because if you don't put enough budget into TV, my logic over the years with TV was Denver Metro. If I could spend $20,000 in that month, I'd hit a home run. And if I tried to spend $5,000, I shouldn't have bothered, right? Yeah. And in Buffalo, it might be 10, 12 right now, right?
And that's based on the number of exposures to the target market.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It had to have enough frequency and enough people. And, you know, of all the media that we can buy, there are two things that if you do it right, are guaranteed winners, which are direct mail and TV. And then everything else, it really takes a lot more effort to get right. Although TV takes a lot of effort to get right too, because if it's the wrong spot, if it's not testimonial laden, if it's not driving immediately to the website, to the phone number, you know, you're going to have a problem because you can't do exposure. My other rule of thumb with TV was, and again, this is why it has to become a big budget thing, is I always had to do all the other print stuff and everything I was going to do at the same time with TV, because TV also ramped up the response rate of everything else, right? So a nice thing about TV that really isn't as much true on everything else is if I hit with a big newspaper campaign at the same time I hit with TV, TV drives the response rate from the newspaper as well as its response rate from the TV. So it has a multiplier effect. I've never seen it work the opposite way. I've never seen newspaper drive up the yellow pages or drive up the internet search traffic or drive up the direct mail response, but I have seen TV drive up the response rate of everything else, right? So the... what's that?
certainly online.
Yeah. But see, I think there's a big opportunity for, as everybody goes to the next level, for that to be the next step, right? And it's also probably, I mean, in our archives, we have some good video footage that at one time Scott had sold NAPNA a pre-done, in fact, Bill Clark's still using it, a pre-done infomercial that we have in the can, sitting there somewhere, and a bunch of 30-second spots. I mean, this was high-end production stuff. You know where that stuff is? It's among the 10,000 tapes somewhere. Has anybody here seen our...
Maybe on beta, so I know where all the beta is, but I can't, like, go put my finger on the disc.
Yeah, they're either on beta or on D1.
So you're saying you might be better off if you had a limited budget to say, for example, I don't know, let's say Lifetime, but whatever. Rob, what was one of the stations that worked well for you?
Lifetime, Food, E, right. Oprah, Bravo, there's one more, TLC.
So let's say you might be better off choosing one of those stations, and if you had a limited budget, and putting all your spots on that one station with a better chance of hitting people repeatedly.
Well, you want to constrain your market geographically if you're going to be on cable, right? So you can you're getting tied. Did you say you can buy by the neighborhood now?
Yeah, it's not what it says, but guys, it depends on what they're going to like to do.
We're buying. Like the four cities around us. It's Wappinger, Fishkill, Hopewell.
How tightly were you able to target?
10 miles. 7 miles, something like that. Whatever that area is. I think it's like 7 miles.
Are you on a monthly contract?
We signed for 3 months, but it's month to month. You can cancel any time.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, what did you say the budget was for that?
Last month was 1,200, this month's 11, next month's 9. They skew it for you.
And for how many spots?
It's 15 to 20 spots a day, 5 days a week for 3 weeks, is what I did. So whatever that comes to, 250 weeks or 750 a month.
Yeah.
But my numbers, you're going to understand where I am, my numbers are not going to be Buffalo.
He's up in the sticks.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get those. Yeah, I think I'm going to be four times at least.
Well, but you have a much better opportunity, frankly.
Right.
Well, because you can be buying broadcast and
he's
you're
got
across
five
multiple locations.
So, I mean, you can split that amongst
But if you're able to do 10 or 12,000 a month, and the way you do it though,
is and Robert, what he said was right. Is I always did 6 week increments, right? And so let's say, and this is relevant to all of your markets. So if you look at, you know, here's January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. Okay? Top of your head, when are bad times to try to be getting people's attention immediately?
July.
Christmas shopping season, right?
So,
middle of summer. So mid-June through mid-August, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's say that we took that out, and we're not going to spend any money there, and we took Thanksgiving to Christmas out. We're not going to spend any money there, right? So you would start with that. Now, December, the day after Christmas, is the best time in the world to buy media because all the big advertisers blew their wad here, and now there through January you can buy media cheap. And so one of my rules of thumb was always I would spend huge budgets right here. So right after Christmas through January. Okay. But then
control the infomercial guys to take key advice too.
Yeah, exactly. But then if you wanna do what Robert was describing as flighting, which is you start on the front end heavy, and then you taper, and then you taper, and then you taper. And if you watch, you'll see a lot of the people
use the Super Bowl to kick off a big flight like that, right? So if you look at, like, the Kia commercial, if that's the one, the white car and the racetrack, you know, the Hopper and all that. Well, what they did is they bought a two-minute or a 90-second or something on the Super Bowl, did this big elaborate production, and they cut it down to a 30-second spot that they're running heavy right now, and then they'll taper off, and then start again, right? So when you look in this cycle, what you would want to do, so like let's say in January, so if I was looking at like Buffalo, I would take, you know, this period of time, so either 6 weeks or longest maybe 2 months, right? And I would stack up the budget here and then have it taper and then start again and then have it taper and then have it start again. And I try to time it in peak time. So right here in May 1st to June 15th is a big summer special blitz, right? And right here, January, February, is a big New Year's blitz. And then right here, starting the end of August, I have a big back-to-school blitz. So now if I was looking to budget through the year, I'm going to spend a ton of money here. I'm going to spend a ton here. I'm going to spend a ton here. And then I'm going to balance it out in here and balance it out in here. Does that make sense? So I wouldn't think in terms of take what I expect to spend this year and divide by 12, right? Is automatically we just dumped 3.5 months, right? And then we've got three periods where I want to go big. So I want to go big here, I want to go big here, I want to go big here. Frankly, I also want to go big in here because it's still, you know, super prime time, especially for the kids market. So I'm going to balance my budget out where I spend a lot here, here, and here, and then taper off through the rest of it, right? But I also then, so see, you do something like, if you're doing TV, you stack it up in 2 or 3 weeks, but then you budget out your newspaper and your direct mail and other stuff fairly even, because this will all get halo bump from this. Does that make sense? So what you go hard on is you go hard on the TV early and the taper off the TV. So in other words, you want to get it where in the first week or so they all see you 7-10 times, right? But then you keep the other things out there and it'll make all the other stuff work better because of the halo effect from the TV. Does that make sense? So I always looked at it that way, right? And the other way is you can do, this is the infomercial, this is the 30-second spots, right? So you saturate the 30-second spots, but you're more consistent with the infomercial. And the infomercial now does better because they're already familiar with you when they stumble into you. Does that make sense? So looking at it at that way, from the standpoint of piecing it all together.
Ed, I'm sorry, someone's hand up. No, when you ran the... I know you had so you run an infomercial, and I remember some of your off-air stuff, not offline, yeah, back in the day. Some of your off-air stuff used to promote the infomercials.
Yeah,
you'd have
exactly.
A mail piece that would say,
yeah,
"Visit the would
because we were buying the same time every week, right? So for a long time we were buying Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. So we would direct them, and it was a broadcast channel, so it was easy to point them at it. So we'd point them at it, and be sure and watch the Mile High Karate. It's like having a public access show, except it was an easy place to find, right? So be sure and watch our, I think it was 31, so be sure and watch the Mile High Karate TV show Saturday morning, 9 a.m. And like all the flyers that would go out in the elementary schools would all have that on it,
right?
For instance.
And you would not cheap out these days, even though we could direct them to a video link where they could watch that same 30-minute program.
They'd have the same effect.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't mean I wouldn't have the video online, mm-hmm, right? But if you were on TV, is, I mean, use everything you got, mm-hmm, right? The nice thing about TV is the halo effect you get, right? Is unlike every other place that you're in media, is all of a sudden you're now a TV star. That's the click that goes off in people's mind. So, you know, when we ran the infomercial consistently, I mean, everywhere I went. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're the karate guy. You know, I mean, it would have an effect everywhere you went, even though maybe we were spending triple the budget in newspaper. Didn't have the same effect. Right.
And because I'm the introvert and Grandma Shung's the extrovert, he can be the TV star.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I walk around.
Absolutely.
I've had at least one. Well, I've had more than one person be missing. So you're Master Chung,
right? Oh, yeah.
So you're Master Chung.
Well, in Washington, it was so thoroughly ingrained that if you wrote down when you went to cash a check and they'd ask you your work phone number, I'd write down the phone number and they'd say, "Oh, you work for June Ring."
Wow.
He used 202 USA 1000. So it would be call USA 1000 now, and it was on all the TV spots. In fact, if you saw Bruce Springsteen at the Grammys, the lead guitar on his left is Nils Lofgren. Nils Lofgren did the music for June Reese spots. But I mean, June Reese was on TV all over the place, and it worked gangbusters. I don't know if he ever did infomercials, but I had great luck with infomercials over the years.
So you had great luck with infomercials. Did you do 30-second spots as well or not?
Oh, yeah. I was saying Mike probably spent $1 million with viewers on TV.
Are the franchisees running it now?
Not so much. See, the dynamic is different, right? Because, you know, I mean, I was spending all the money for the 5 or 6 locations. They're spending their own money.
Right.
And so, it, as I said before, is the makeup of the franchisees are not too different than makeup in this room, in that a lot of them are hitting such home runs out in fairs and carnivals and schools and so forth that I'm trying to shift them to the quality of life syndrome and get them spending money. But we don't have any of them spending that kind of money right now.
So if we could drop $10,000 a month and do it, you'd say do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I would think, I don't know what Buffalo's population and how your cable is, but I was doing all of Charlotte and Buffalo. Maybe Charlotte's a little bigger now.
Right,
yeah. If I'm breaking even on one school and you're doing 5 schools, this should be a no-brainer.
Exactly.
And Eric, your budget, how much?
That was $2,000 a month.
$2,000
a month. It's a special deal. I never would have done it, but it's a third of what it usually is. Usually it would be $6,000.
Right. I think they're pitching us in around 4.
Yeah.
And again, I'd have to look at the frequency and reach, but I think they're pitching me in about 4.
5 schools.
Well, I mean, I was trying
to... But here's the way I would do it. Yes, I would do, you know, what would you guesstimate your annual ad budget is?
Again, to be honest, real low.
Yeah.
Because the grassroots stuff is working, but willing and able to put 10, 12 a month, you know, willing to put 10 a month, I would say, if we needed to.
Well, let's say it's 120 a year.
Right.
Okay. Well, now what it is let's say we kicked off in March. Okay. Well, let's say April.
But that's not all TV though, right? That $10,000.
Well, we don't spend much now because we do so much grassroots stuff.
But. Yeah, they're doing a lot of grassroots and a lot of internal referrals and events, which is great. But let's say that I kick off here. What I'd love to see is 25,000 in 6 weeks, okay, and then back off another 25,000 in 6 weeks, back off another 25,000 in 6 weeks, and then maybe 15. I'd rather stage it that way. So I'd like to see you maybe do 4 hits of 40,000 in a short period of time and then back off. You'll have much better results that way. Because what will happen is everybody in Buffalo will see it 12 times.
Right.
And everything else you're doing will jump from that. And Eric, when you were trying to judge your return on investment, were you tracking the direct response from TV or were you trying to judge the halo effect?
I think it had a halo effect, but I didn't have any accurate way to track it.
Yeah.
When you say you broke even, was that just on the initial enrollments? Did you figure lifetime value?
I'm figuring lifetime value.
Yeah.
But in your case, like last time we spoke, and I've spoken a while, you weren't looking for more students, you were looking to create upgrades and more things. Has that changed? Or do you
know, obviously, you know, as far as I can tell, I have the lowest student value in the room, you know, based on the questionnaire things that we have. So that's why we said about vastly undercharging.
Because unless you suddenly want a rush of relatively low quality leads coming in, it sounds like you already have like a good base.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess.
That, well, that, now, now that you just said something we haven't discussed yet.
Extremely important.
Yeah, extremely valuable. Think in terms of quality of lead response now. Okay, so here's it, long form, repetitious direct mail. Let's say, other than referrals and such, that's to go buy a traffic, that's the highest quality person you're going to get. Okay, so go down from there, and now a 30-second radio spot and a 30-second TV spot is down at the other end of the spectrum. Where? Oh, you guys want to break for lunch at 1? That sound good? Okay,
sure.
Yeah. So what's going to happen as you open the spigot is you're going to flood more lower quality people in, mm-hmm. right? And there are ways to mitigate that. One way you can mitigate it is by driving to a website, get them more educated before you do it. That tamps down the response a little bit, but it gets them to be a little bit more qualified. Yeah, when you're on TV, I mean, you get the 12-year-old who's calling you, who hasn't talked to his mom, and right. you get all of that stuff too. See, what I like about TV is the fact that it makes everything else work better. Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing that I like about TV is I can control it without trying to do the herd the cats and get all the all the other things to happen. But the easy spot on there is you've got to be like in a place that you want to like flood the place. I mean, I've had the other experience where we spent a ton of money, put 486 people in the doors in 6 weeks, and the staff couldn't handle it and flushed them all out the back end. So, you know. Five schools, 100 students on average per school, all driven predominantly by media, but it was too much for them. Mm-hmm. So you can screw your system up by putting too many people in.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's where I'm at. The growth in the last 9 months has been so substantial that my systems were set up for 250, and now we're over 250, and I'm scrambling.
Yeah, it's all falling apart, and it's time to fix it.
I don't know about falling apart, but yeah, it's definitely time to fix it.
Well, falling apart from relative. I mean, the ratios aren't as tight everywhere as you want them to be.
Maybe a little. We haven't seen much of a drop. For me, it's more just overwhelming. There's just too much going on at once.
Okay. But again, I mean, we can outline specifically, but if that was the number, I would chunk it up into about 5 big hits. Right. It's not a media where you want to be consistent. It's a media where you want to make a lot of noise and then back off for a while making a lot of noise.
Sure.
Is this helpful for everybody else? I don't want to be on it. But I do think I bet in Bermuda you could blow the doors off.
Yeah, I could. I want to make sure I get the right people in the door. I don't want the assholes here. Yeah. But I know that, but I can do direct marketing. I can drive around the neighborhoods, mm-hmm. which you guys do the same thing if you wanted to, and just see where all the cool homes are, who's got the big homes, who's got the swimming pool, who's got the playground. You all can do that too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I mean, you look at it from a different aspect, and then I can direct market direct to the house.
Well, here's where part of the selectivity on a broadcast media is twofold. One is if you target who's seen it, right? It's what Toby said about radio is, conservative talk. Is the only thing that I'm not sure is right about that is the conservative talk skews heavily male, and we're trying to get to moms for the kids market, right? So on every other way, I would agree with him. I'm not sure there's a female skewing talk radio alternative to that. But the TV thing is part of the way that you mitigate that was a list of programs that he was buying there, right? Because they have demographics on each of the programs, so you know what the income range is, you know what the male-female split is,
right.
you know that, right? So, I mean, if you wanted it to, skew 150,000 and up and buy it on TV, you can do that, right?
Yeah, the thing is, in Bermuda, they're buying cable, the stealing cable, one or two, from a U.S. broadcast. So I'm not able to advertise within the cable listing. I can probably advertise just in the local, which is on cable. But out of, let's say, 300 channels...
When you're getting TV, who are you buying it from?
We're buying it from a cable provider.
Yeah, who's the cable provider?
The name of it? It's called Cablevision.
Well, the Cablevision can insert long form and short form into the programs.
Within channels that...
It doesn't matter who the programming is. You can buy BBC in Denver.
When you make buy it, though, you may
You can buy Al Jazeera if you want to.
But you're buying it from somebody. Cablevision may be based on the states, the piece that you're getting, but you're buying it from somebody. Cablevision's who we have, where we are.
Yeah,
it's who we're advertising with. And they just insert the commercial, and basically what they do is if someone bought a national commercial, they stick your commercial in over there as an overlay. So that they don't play the national commercial that's supposed to run instead, they play yours.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. The range of programming that's on behind the scenes. If I don't know if you guys who know George Chung is, he was a national forum competitor. One of the things he does is he buys basically wholesale time on TV and either resells it or does programming. So like his company did an MMA show at the Playboy Mansion and put it on the air for time that they had bought wholesale from unused airtime. The WCL League, the Chuck Norris's thing, is they were basically buying the airtime from TLC. So what TLC will do is they'll give you an hour, and they won't give you money for production, but they'll give you spots that you can use yourself, right? So, I'm making this up. McCoy and Sawyer are in this business. Let's say that there's 10 TV spots in the thing. TLC will give you 5 of them that you can use or sell and keep 5 of them that they can use or sell. And then you pay the production. So at the low end, like some of the martial arts stuff you've seen on TV and stuff, it wasn't that, like in ESPN's case, they give you $100,000 for the production and you keep whatever's left over. It's more like you go pay for the production. That's why, WCL, Chuck had put like $5 million into it. But they were paying for all the production and then giving them a pre-done show and keeping like 5 spots that they could go resell to try to recoup their costs. But that trickles down because now the local cable providers, they have donutted in spots that they put spots in, and they have a certain number on every show. It probably varies by show. They have fewer on American Idol than they do on, O Network. But then they have shows that they can put spots in, and if they haven't sold all the inventory, which they never do, then they just recycle your stuff because they got to put something in there, right? So they either put house ads or they'll, it's nothing for them to give you another 200 spots because they have 10,000 unsold inventory. So they just keep running something whenever they need to run it. And occasionally you'll see like their own house ad that pops up every 5 minutes, or you'll see a PSA that pops up every 5 minutes. That means they have a lot of unsold inventory. So like in January, February, you see a lot of crap that you wouldn't see otherwise because they couldn't give it away. So they are just running other stuff. Does that make sense? But yeah, I mean, you should be on TV. Okay, so we're gonna break for lunch. Let's do this as kind of a sense of what we have to accomplish today. Let me throw out some goals that I have for everybody. I want to see a bunch of people. At that kind of net this year. Okay, so that's one goal. Now, in some cases, that's more than you're grossing right now. Okay, another goal that I have is to have 250 to 300 average revenue per student. Each of you. And number three is to have your marketing where it's fairly automated so you're not killing yourself to keep people flooding in the doors. Okay? Now, By automated, I don't think we're in an industry where sequential autoresponders and, you know, pre-programmed voicemail and stuff. I don't think that's the thing that's going to work for us. But I know from experience, with a combination of TV and direct mail and appropriate web presence and so forth, you can do that, and you can do it without having to. And again, like in a sick school environment, I always knew I was going to have two people who weren't going to do anything. Otherwise, I always knew that I had two that were going to make a half-hearted effort and two that were going to hustle. And so my rule of thumb was to have all the schools with enough traffic, no matter what happened otherwise, that they were all at break-even or above, and therefore the guys who hustled would make a ton of money, right? And so that was always my rule of thumb. And I think the most I ever spent in a month is around $100,000. But that wasn't the norm. My norm was probably 160 to 180 a year was the ad budget. Most of that time across five locations. So
about 10.
That's 12 to 15.
Yeah. Maybe a little
less. 12 to 15.
12 to 15 a month, probably closer to 15.
But that's over the five locations.
$3,000. Yeah.
So you recommend anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 a month on a single?
Well, Hafner, when he was running at peak, was spending 12 a month.
Okay. We did 5,500 last month, and like I said, it was the best month we ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. When he was at peak, here was the number. And I just use that as a microcosm of a single school, right? Because again, I mean, hell, I've never run a single school, to tell you the truth. But as a microcosm of a single school, he was spending around $12,000 a month, doing 22 enrollments a month, grossing around $100,000 a month, netting around $50,000. And with an inflated payroll, because he had both kids and his brother on the payroll at the time, okay? And they were all making, you know, good money. So, and I, ironically, by the way, is about half of those enrollments were from internal referral activities and so forth. So, it was 11 enrollments on 12,000, and the numbers don't quite add up, because I know that his dollar was costing about $750 to $800 to get a new student. So I'm a little off here somewhere, right? But he was spending about $800 to get a new student. The lifetime value was about $5,000, and so that must mean either this number is a little high, or this ratio is a little off, right? But that's what the numbers were. So if he was, so let's say he was getting if you divide 12,000 by 800, you get 15. So this might be right. 15. And then you subtract out from there, so
that
you've got,
good.
You know, 8 or 9 internal.
Seven.
There you go. That might have been more like what it was, right?
I could see us doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if we had the percentage.
Say it again.
I'll just ask a quick question, if I may. The 12,000 is advertising spend or marketing total spend?
How are you defining the difference?
Advertising is going to be newspaper, it's going to be a TV spot. Marketing in general is going to be other programs, including direct mail, including website, including mobile initiatives, etc.
Marketing. Yeah, the more inclusive now.
So,
I wouldn't necessarily define it that way, but what I'm not including is the labor that went into any of this stuff, right? So if it was printing, direct mail, buying pay-per-click, any and all of those.
So am I being too, you know, when I sat down with the rep, and let's say she showed me $4,000 a month, mm-hmm. and I said, all right, well, you know what, I mean, I probably should be better at those numbers, but I was saying, all right, well, I'm willing to do $400 per new student acquisition.
Right.
So this has got to pull me, you know, 10 new students, mm-hmm. roughly knowing our ratios, okay, so I've got to get 20 good quality, you know, inquiries out of that.
Right.
And I wasn't, you know, I just wasn't convinced it was going to make the phone ring mm-hmm. that many times. But, so Eric, when you were running, you were getting, for whatever you were running, you were getting, because I would imagine unless your new student acquisition number that you were comfortable with was much higher. Were you getting 20, 30 phone calls a month off of those spots?
I really don't remember the...
Were the ratios that much tighter?
I doubt it.
Well, at 2,000, you only need to sign a couple people up, right?
Right. At 2,000, I'd say, okay, I need to get five students from this, so I need 10 phone calls.
I needed to sign up one student a month to break even. Yeah. So I was a little ahead of that, but it wasn't like I was signing up, you know, six students a month for my...
But again, you're doing it, yeah, doing it based on the lifetime value.
Yeah. But the contract I had to do a 12-month contract, and I had to spread it out over the... equally each month.
Right.
So it wasn't ideal.
Yeah.
If you can do it in your ideal times and you're doing it multiple schools.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, like I said, also you get the rush of students, high enough quality.
Yeah.
But you can control it. I didn't do enough to control that.
Right.
It's like ads. We're not branded like Mercedes, but Mercedes is not getting 1,000 calls from
the wrong demographic.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
so
I think
we have to, in our ads, make sure we're making clear.
Right. It's been years, but again, yeah, when we ran the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the Power Ranger type stuff, that's when you get the 9-year-olds calling and whatever.
Right.
And I'm thinking if you're doing Cooking Channel and the
Lifetime
movie of the week.
Yeah.
Well, and consider, too, I think you have to keep in mind that it was a famous kickboxing
ad
for women.
Oh, okay.
In January.
Right, sure.
So, I think that's a pretty dramatic skew of what you're going to see. And I also think you're going to see a pretty dramatic difference in response.
Right.
Not only rate, but in who's responding.
I mean, buying leads was what I listed as possibly one of our bigger successes for this year, but I want to do much more of it
because
we're at this stage. I'm sorry. It's still going to – well, it's kids with them with probably a similar philosophy that the kids come in with a parent.
Right.
And
you're trying to enroll the kid.
But enroll the kid, yeah. But I think that so
I was Taekwondo character development.
So, I was not anticipating buying any of the kids' shows itself. I don't know if that's a mistake.
No, I think you're probably right. And you are right when you're buying some kids' shows that mom's not likely watching. You're getting a lot more junk than you would have gotten otherwise. We're at lunch break. It is a fairly complicated topic, right? And the last thing that we didn't say is. You don't want to deal with the sales reps directly. You want to go get a media buyer, right? So, and so you should find a good media buyer who, you know, they're getting the 15% agency commission, and you know, you can go buy your own media and get the 15% agency commission and set up your own little ad agency thing. But frankly, for the first few times, what you should do is you should get a media buyer but milk them, right? So. Don't let them give you a recommendation. Go through all the logic of why the recommendation and how it all did, and then beat them up for really beating up the price. A good media buyer oftentimes will be able to buy the media for a third less than you can get it, and then they're getting 15% of the gross, so, you know, more power to them. And again, you can set up XYZ Advertising Corp and get 15%. On the media, but I'd rather have a media buyer. But again, milk them. I mean, it's the same thing. Anything that you do that you're going to do repetitiously and you hire an expert, make sure that part of what the expert's doing, whether they know it or not, is they're educating you how to be as good as they are at it. And even if you don't replace them, I mean, any expert you buy has good days and bad days, and they have good months and bad months. And you want to make sure you double check that their thinking when they were good is the same as it was when they had an off month. I've had a bunch of several attorneys over the years say, you know, the quote I gave you was to get it done for you, not to teach you how to do it.
Mm.
You know, our franchise attorneys, you know, they're like, you know, I joined the Bar Association, read all the books, did all the stuff, you know, knew more than the associates did about the, you know, asked questions they'd never heard before. And our lead attorney was really good, so she found it... breath of fresh air. But I actually had a guy once, we did a private placement memorandum, and he got pissy. He said, well, I quoted you $15,000, not, it would have been 30 if I knew I was going to teach you how to do it. It was 15 for me to do it. But make sure, but that is an important thing on TV. Not so much anything else, but get a good media buyer, and then they will really delve into the cost per thousand impressions and so forth. They can beat up on the price points, but also then they can educate you on how to go about that process.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I was gonna ask a question. The question was, I know that we had those demographics or 22. What was the demographics? Because I know we got the demographics and psychographics of it.
Right.
So we had 22 enrolled in the one that you just talked about. In Bermuda, is a different demographic and a different psychographic as well. So, the population, let's say, for instance, you had a population of 100,000.
Yeah.
What would be your...
Well, the Hafner's situation works out perfectly for you because that was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so I don't know about the psychographics, but the demographics works very common.
So it was the same as like 60,000 or 30... What was it? It was 60,000?
I think Ann Arbor's maybe 80 max.
80 max, okay.
You know, it's a constrained market,
right.
College market. So you have to weed out the... I think his population is maybe 90, but 40,000 are attached to the university, so you got to get rid of those. And then, you know, it's where Michigan plays, the University of Michigan, so they've got like the biggest football stadium and all that stuff.
Right.
But the college does him no good. So, you know, he's probably really marketing to 60, 80.
80, okay. So I have to have that, actually, because I'm probably got like 22,000. But I just think the matter is keep educating. I'm just looking at the ratio.
Sean, all we need to do is blow out TV and then do all the targeted mail.
Right,
and the targeted mail response will go up 20-25% because they've seen you everywhere.
Every year.
And that's, and we're getting a lot of that too. We're getting many you guys are everywhere.
Here's a.
We're doing
half let's do lunch. What is it, 10 after 1? Back at 2:30?
Sir.
Does that work?